This conversation with Ted Sherman took place at the Latah County Museum Society in Moscow on June 17, 1976. The interviewer was Sam Schrager. That's George Moore Miller.
Oh, yes. Well, he was, I think probably if there was any one person in the faculty that everybody knew, it was George Maury Miller. He'd been here a few years before I came, but I met him on the day I enrolled, and we had quite an argument because I wanted to take a course that freshmen weren't supposed to take, but it was a course in journalism, and I'd done had some practical experience. He said, okay. He forgave me when I went out for debate. And then we stayed good friends up until the time of his death. He came to visit my folks in Boise and gave me lots of good advice when I was first getting started. I think the Bill Banks summed George Maury up in a nutshell. He said that he was a combination of Falstaff, Sam Johnson, and Mr. Pickwick. He said he has Falstaff's love of the good things of life, and Sam Johnson's intellect and irascibility, and Pickwick's benevolence. And that just about summed it up. He was rather heavy. He had a scratchy kind of a voice. He was interested in everybody and in everything. He wanted to know, if you had an unusual name, he wanted to know where you got it. He liked to know where you came from. When I came to Moscow on the faculty, of course in his department, the first contact I had with him, I was on 3rd Street, and I had my two children with me, and heard this old cracked voice from across the street and 15-20 feet farther along, "Hey, Pat, wait a minute!" And I looked over, and there's George Maury. "Just wait a minute, don't go anywhere." I just had parked the car. In a minute here, he came back across the street with ice cream cones for the two kids, and shook hands and welcomed me to town. But that was the start with George Maury. I think one of the, everybody in town knew him, as well as everybody on the campus. You can see how well known he was when, at least 15 or 20 years after his death, on one very bad winter day I was in the Moscow Hotel barber shop, and somebody said, "Well, this has certainly been an awful winter," and someone else says, "Yes, it's about the worst one we've had since George Maury died." Didn't need to say Miller. And every one of the four barbers and two of us who were in the chairs, I think there was only one person in the shop, two or three waiting, every one of them had something that he remembered and wanted to talk about George Maury Miller. That was what happened when you just got the kind of cross section that's in a barber shop. Everybody knew the old boy.
He made that kind of an impression on people that everyone remembered.
Everybody remembered him. He had idiosyncrasies, but he was warm-hearted. His home was the most hospitable place that anyone could ever hope to find. His wife was a very, very sensitive, very talented woman. She wrote a good deal. I never had a chance to read what she wrote, but some of the people that did, Cushman, for example, I thought she had a real talent of writing. And George Maury was absolutely devoted to her, and she to him. I mentioned the year that George Maury died. One of the most dramatic things I remember about him was that the last two Christmases in which he was alive, my wife and I and our daughter were guests at their house for Christmas dinner. I think the reason that we were picked out among everybody in Moscow was his friend. The reason I think we were picked out was that we happened to be the only people in town that knew a young man that one of their sons was spending Christmas with. This young man happened to be a cousin of mine, and he and Smithbetter, one of George Borey's sons, were spending Christmas together, and we were the only ones that could talk to him about this Lewis Shaw that his son was with. And so he asked us, and the first of these 2 years, everything was perfect. Mrs. Miller was a wonderful cook and served meals beautifully, and all the people were coming in all the time we weren't eating. Everybody wanted to come and see the Millers on Christmas. And the turkey was perfect. When the plum pudding came on, it was blazing beautifully. And it was just a storybook occasion. The next year, George Morey had a heart attack in early November. I can even come up with a date, November 7th. I'll tell you why I know the date in a minute or two. And he had to stop teaching and hadn't been back on the campus and was in bad condition. But nevertheless, against the doctor's orders, he put on his robe and came down. They asked us to Christmas dinner again. They didn't want to have it seen that they couldn't have Christmas dinner just because he was so very ill. And this time, things seemed to go wrong. I can't remember everything, but just some little thing wouldn't be quite perfect the way it had been before. And Mrs. Miller, for the first time in her life, I ever knew that she didn't have everything so she could cope with it perfectly. And to cap the climax, when they brought in the plum pudding, they couldn't make the brandy light. And so the plum pudding wouldn't blaze. And the difference between those two, well, George was so striking. He came down, he insisted on coming down, even in his dressing gown, and when he wasn't supposed to, but he would keep on going no matter what happened. If he wanted to do something, he'd do it. And that was the last day I saw him alive. Within the next month, he and Mrs. Miller were both dead. I never saw either of them alive again. She had a cancer that was incurable, and he didn't even know it on that occasion. Neither did anyone else.
Which year was that? Do you remember?
That was, I think, the winter of 1936 and 37. I'm pretty sure that was right. The reason I remember the date, the exact date when he got sick so well, was that I got a call at 8 o'clock on a Sunday evening, asking me to take his class in Victorian literature, which met the next morning at 8 a.m. And he said, "Tad, I want you to take my class in Victorians. I'm sick and I can't make it." And I said, "Well, all right, but it's not very long to get ready for it." It was his pet class and had faculty members, one local clergyman, and some faculty wives in it. He said, "Well, talk about Browning. You can always talk about Browning without any time to get ready." And so I went in.
Were you a Browning specialist?
I had done a good deal of work with Browning. I'd written a master's thesis on Browning, and he was my hobby, as George Morey knew. George Morey says, "I've been talking about Tennyson. It's time to start Browning anyway." And he said, "You can probably keep up with Browning until I get back." But he never did get back. And I finished the semester of the course and taught it the next semester, and actually went on teaching that course until the time I retired. I remember the date so well because that stuck in my mind, that from November 7th until the end of the semester, I was teaching George Morey's class in Victorians.
Was his son and your cousin, were they both in Boise?
They were in Los Angeles.
Oh.
This was a cousin of mine, first cousin once removed, named Shaw, and he was living in Los Angeles, and that's where Smith Miller and he got they got acquainted actually through Talbot Jennings, because Jennings was a good friend of this cousin and his whole family, and Jennings was also a very good friend of the Millers, and through Smith Miller, this cousin of mine, and Talbot Jennings, this cousin of mine, and Smith Miller got acquainted and hit it off very well, and I think for a while they shared an apartment, but I'm not sure of that.
Was George Morey Miller very concerned about his son? Was he the kind of man that would really
Oh, no, he wasn't concerned. He just wanted to know more about the man that Smith Miller had shared an apartment with this good friend of his son's down there. No, he wasn't worried about him. Nobody ever needed to worry about Smith Miller. He's very capable. He can take care of himself anywhere. And I think that's why there was something a little bit special that we had that nobody else had. I don't mean that I was his closest friend. We were close friends, but a great many other people could say the same thing. And
what made him a great person? What was it that was so special about him?
Well, of course, he was there's his scholarship, and I respected George Morey as a scholar. But I think it was the interest he took in everybody else and the warmth of his personality and his hospitality. But perhaps more than anything else, that George Morey took an interest in you. He knew all of his faculty. He knew all about their children. He wanted to know if he met somebody. He wanted to find out more. Oh, you could go on about George Morey forever. He loved to go hunting, and I can remember. And he came from Indiana, of course. And his hunting dog, was named Hoosier. And both George Morey and Hoosier were getting pretty well along toward the time when they weren't going hunting anymore. And I can remember on one occasion when he called his office at the university and said to the secretary, "I won't be in to work this morning. Hoosier died." And hung up. That was... I think he probably, I don't mean he wasn't attached to the dog, but I guess he felt, well, this is the beginning of the end of an era. He used to go out, he'd get his shotgun and go out in the hills within 300 or 400 yards of his house, even when he couldn't go anywhere else. Thinking of his hunting, he loved to go fishing too. And one episode of his in fishing involved one of my closest friends, Jeffrey Coop, and another member of the department, John Beckwith, and George Morey. George Morey had gone hunting until they told him, the doctor said, if you go out and try to climb those hills again, you'll probably have to be carried back. But this time, George Morey wanted to go fishing, and Jeffrey and John Beckwith had gone fishing with him before, and so they took George Morey fishing. They went out to one of these streams, I don't remember which one, and they had this understanding that Jeffrey would start downstream and John would start upstream, that each one would go quite a distance up or downstream as the case might be, and George Morey would fish between them. And they suggested that. They said, well, we can't all fish at the same place and this is closer, so you take this. And they had it in mind, they'd do it that way, because if anything happened to George Morey, one or the other of them would catch him, would find him. Well, they carried out their plan, one fishing upstream, one fishing downstream, and finally they met. Neither of them had encountered George Morey in the meantime, and they were just worried to death. They knew he had angina, they knew that he could have heart attacks, and they didn't see how they could have missed him, but there they were, and just worried to death, and they went the first few hundred yards up and downstream again, and then didn't know what else to do, but they just stood where they'd met and both yelled at the top of the voice, "George Morey, George Morey, George Morey, where are you?" From 100, 150 yards off in a field somewhere came a voice, "I'm right over here, I'm right over here, nothing the matter, don't get excited." And they went over there. They had just been, they'd wondered how he was heavy, how they'd ever carry him out. And there was old George Morey. He was sitting in the shade of a rock, drinking beer. He said, "I busted a blood vessel in my leg," he says, "so I decided better not fish anymore." And they looked down, kind of blood on his sock there, but that was all. He didn't get excited. "I busted a blood vessel in my leg." But they said that they were just almost mad enough to beat him up, because they had just been sick and they'd been wondering what has happened. And there it was, George Morey was perfectly happy, sitting in the shade, drinking beer. No, he was in. And nobody that knew him would ever forget the old boy.
Was he did he hold forth as a speaker? I mean, was he a very man with?
Well, when he really took the time to prepare, he could give a wonderful lecture. Lots of times he didn't really do justice to himself in the classroom, but he could give a fine lecture and he could give a very fine talk. I don't know that he had any special reputation as a speaker. He wasn't one of those. Chenoweth was the one that had the reputation as the university's speaker. But I had another lucky break with George Morey. When I said he got a little bit angry at me when I wanted to take this course in journalism that freshmen weren't supposed to take. But he just felt there were certain books that everybody should read. He used to lecture to the whole freshman class in English once a week. And he put copies of 3 books on reserve. And everybody was supposed to do some reading in those. And the old boy went in 6 weeks later, and I happened to be the only one that had ever taken any of those books off reserve and done any reading in them. Well, from then on, he forgave me for wanting to take a journalism class.
Do you remember what those books were?
Oh, let's see. I think one of them was Alice in Wonderland. I can't remember what the other two were, though. One of them I do remember was Alice in Wonderland. And
I had read, I think it was in Beacon Mountain Plain, the downtown, there was a place that he used to hang out and hold forth, and people would listen to him. Was there any place in particular? I can't remember that now.
That was Jerry's.
How was it Jerry's?
That was at Jerry's. Jerry Jelwick was the man that operated it. You may have heard other people referring about Jerry's, and you know where it is. It's, what do they call it now?
It's a Mexican
It's a Mexican, Casa Helena or something like that now. It's had other names. But that was where you, like, if George Morey was hanging out anywhere downtown, that's where you'd like, were very likely to find him. Well, his enthusiasm was contagious. As you, I think, mentioned when we were talking before, this enthusiasm about ballads and anything that came close to folk literature or anything of that sort, he created a whole interest in the town and the university and the state on that particular time.
He really maintained faithfulness to balladry and folklore.
Oh yes, he was enthusiastic about that until the day that he died. I think he never lost his interest there. I had a seminar with him once, and I can remember that when he wanted to explain his theory of communal origin of the popular ballad, that he would explain how a bunch of primitives around the fire, that they were acting out really the things that they had done, and that one of them would say, "I'm the great bear of the mountain," and jump into the middle of the circle, and someone else brandishing a weapon, "I kill the great bear of the mountain," and that would be the way that the ballad, just tossing in lines like that, would be somehow that ballad would be put together. And he always used that same illustration, "I kill the great bear of the mountain." So he had the seminar up to his house before Christmas, so we brought him a Christmas present. We bought a teddy bear, and we stuck a spear into it and spread red ink all around it and said that we had, for his benefit, we had stuffed the great bear of the mountain, which he had killed so often. He thought that was more fun. Well, once in a while somebody would get him just a little bit provoked. Howard Pakenham, one of the early old timers, a member of our department, a good friend, we were supposed to do something about old reports on these ballads in this seminar, and Pakenham, I don't know whether he hadn't had time to prepare anything serious or not, but he started out with what he said was an attempt to find racial traits in the versions of the ballad as they differed from race to race. And Dr. Miller thought that was fine. Then it turned out that Pakenham had done such things to see whether the Scotch The version of a ballad was more showed their tendency to be stingy by referring to money more often, that sort of thing.
He didn't go for that too much.
And he stayed good natured, but you could just see that he thought, this is serious business, this ballad. And let's see, Beckenham had burlesques of some of the ballads that were supposed to show what would be done with them under various circumstances. I can remember one. Packenham's version, "Oh, mither, mither, make me a pie, and make it soft and gooey. I feel that I must have pie tonight, or I will go kaflooey." And he went off through the whole thing, parodying one ballad or another that starts, "Oh, mother, mother, do so and so." Pack had his own sense of humor that was put him in a class by himself. But Miller never gave up his love of ballads and folk literature.
Ballads were the centerpiece of his interest in folk literature. Was ballads?
Yes, they were. Mm-hmm. The popular ballad, and his theory that no one person would write them, but that they would be sort of brought into existence by a little bit from here and a little bit from there, and you couldn't say who wrote them because they weren't the work of an individual. They grow out of an authentic folk situation.
Well, you talk about the traits, his own traits is coming perhaps from these combination of these three great characters. What about his irascibility? Could he get thunderously angry when he got mad?
Oh, he'd get, I don't know that he was ever thunderously angry, but he'd get pretty hot and pretty hostile. I never happened to be there when he really blew his top, as they'd say now, but if he thought somebody was on the wrong track entirely, he would not hesitate to say so. He used to love to garden. He turned up once, I know, on the campus in the coveralls. He had a class to meet, and he hadn't had time to change clothes. A Chinese student, wanted to take his picture. He said he wanted to take it back to China to show that in the United States, a college professor's really worked. No, he was a very, very colorful character.
Do you think that his friendship extended to helping students find a career in English and an interest in their own development in terms of work in literature?
Yes, I think so. Of course, I think it was through Miller's recognition of Talbot Jennings' ability that Jennings really got his opportunity to study under George Pierce Baker, which of course was the beginning gave him the contacts that launched him on his career.
Who was George Pierce Baker?
He was probably the best known man in the country in drama and drama workshop and that sort of thing. And Miller was so pleased with Talbot's work on the pageanteer. See, Baker was at Yale for a while and at Harvard for a while, and I don't remember where he was when Talbot went back. But that was, he was the best known man in the country in that, and he was a man who could give a person the opportunity to make contacts with people in the theater.
Was the pageant, the most important work that Talbot Jennings did when he was here? Was that his real creative splash?
Well, that was the first splash. That was the thing that established him as a man with a great deal of talent in writing. I don't know whether, the only other thing I know about that Talbot wrote while he was here that drew much attention was a treatment of Romeo and Juliet, which was done here, and then out of that he developed the treatment that I believe it was Leslie Howard acted in later in the movie version. And I wasn't here when he did that, so I can't speak with so much certainty about just when he did it.
Were you here for the pageant?
Oh yes, I was on the book committee that wrote the pageant. I didn't contribute anything, but
Can you tell me a little bit of background on the development of that pageant and how it came about?
Well, it was Dr. Miller's enthusiasm. He decided we should have a pageant. And what would have come of it if he didn't? This was before he realized the talent Talbot Jennings could bring to it. But Dr. Miller decided that we should give a pageant to the early development of Idaho. And so he was instrumental in getting a committee put to work on it. Jennings was on the committee. I was on it. I don't know for sure whether Ruth Boies was on it or not. She might have been. And I can't remember. Oh, Cushman was on it. Of course, he was in charge of drama at the university at that time. And we had to meet quite regularly, Saturday morning at 8 o'clock. After I missed a couple meetings, George Morey got the habit of having me called at 7:30 in the morning on Saturday, so I did some freshman answer the phone at the house, and he'd say, "If Sherman isn't up, go and wake him up. This is George Morey. Tell him he's to get over to my office at 8 o'clock. There's a meeting." But it soon turned out that Talbot was the one that had the had what it took to produce the pageant. And I can't remember that much of anyone else wrote much of any part of the pageant. I know that I didn't contribute anything except applause now and then. But Jennings really had what it took. He had the natural talent and he had the background for it because his father had been an Episcopal clergyman here in early times, and he was named after Bishop Talbot, who was an early Episcopal bishop in Idaho, and so his background made him really appreciative of Idaho and a natural interest in its history, with his own parents having his own father having contributed to it in that manner. And whether Talbot discovered himself then, or whether he knew he could write all the time, I don't know.
Was he raised around here, or was it where in Idaho did he come from?
Nampa originally.
Nampa.
I'm pretty sure. It was either Nampa or Caldwell. I think Nampa though, but I would not swear to that.
Well, the actual performance of the pageant the first time was quite a big production, wasn't it?
Oh yes, it had to be big. They brought Indians up from the Lapway from that reservation, I don't know how many people were in that, but it was they had a big cast, and of course they had dancing and they had singing. I don't remember any choruses, but a cowboy singing a ballad on the range, and they had Idaho, the light on the mountain. Gabe Goff was the first Idaho, and they had an old artificial horse that they had from a harness shop, and at a certain time there'd come this thunder of the drums and the light would turn up and there'd be Abe Goff on the horse. Nobody could recognize Abe, he was way high above the crowd. It was a big and ambitious job, no doubt about it.
How was it staged?
What was
the staging like? Where and then?
Well, it's staged on what was then the football and baseball field, which is where the women's physical ed building is now. And it was kind of a natural amphitheater effect, the way that the land came up behind it, so that people could sit there and watch it in that manner. But it took an immense amount of staging to do. It's been given four times. Once here and it was given here in the spring of 1923 and given in Boise then in the fall of either 24 or 25. 24, I'm sure. And then it's been given here twice since then. And the original idea was they'd give it once every 4 years, but that turned out to be impractical. It takes an immense amount of organization and enthusiasm and pooling of talents to make it go, and quite an expenditure of money too. But
so I take it George Moore Miller was probably very pleased with the with the realization of his idea.
Oh, yes, he was delighted about that. No question, that was really one of the great events of his time here, was having that pageant, which, of course, was produced 3 more times before his death. And I don't remember when the last year was. I think it was done here, 1927 or 8 or somewhere along in there. And then a third time, it was the third time it was done in Moscow, that is, was somewhere in the early 30s. I know I was on the faculty at that particular time. There'd be bits of humor would come. I think that one of their dances was the dance of the spirits that were trying to bring down the rain out of the dry places. And it had been raining all through the pageant up until the time. And then the spirits of rain began to get out and dance and try to bring down the rain. And the rain stopped. And I'm a scene in Idaho City, I believe this was in Idaho City, where somebody was saying, "Get your bets down, gentlemen, have your bets down, everything down, everything down," and just then the wind blew over one of the pieces of scenery. But though, you can't give a thing of that size and not have time to go through it 50 times to perfect it without having a few little quirks, but that didn't spoil it. It was a wonderful experience. I think in connection with doing original things in general, that when people see something original, I think of this because of my own connection with musical comedies and writing the lyrics for musical comedies and that sort of thing, that when they see a professional production on Broadway, or after it's been on Broadway, they're seeing it after it has had a trial run in Boston, another in Philadelphia, and they've juggled the cast, they have eliminated what they thought was weak, they've built it up where they thought it was good and could be a little bit more emphasized. And what they see is not the first production. What they see is after it's had the work of professional experts and has been in front of an audience time after time after time, so that you can see where it could be improved. Whereas if you do something that is put on the stage before an audience for the first time, when you actually see it, you don't have the advantage of all of that. And if you could take this thing that is done originally and move to and have a trial run in Seattle or Spokane or so forth, and then bring it here and put it on, you would see a vastly improved production.
Well, did this have more than a dress rehearsal, this pageant? Probably had very little...
The first time it had been done before a big audience. I wasn't there while they had all the rehearsals, but it's pretty hard to get all those things
together,
to bring it all together. You can't bring up 50 or 100 Indians, I don't remember how many, and their horses and so forth from Lapway, and keep them here for several dress rehearsals. And you have, it's pretty hard to put it all together. A thing of the pageant like that, I don't know whether they ever put it all together before the night that it opened. I don't remember how many nights it ran, but it's just as too big a thing to do all at once. Until it's really for pay, or when it's the payoff and you have a crowd.
I was going to ask you, when did you do some musical comedy writing?
Oh, well, I don't know whether that's enough Moscow history to be...
Well, it's about yourself, and that's...
Yeah, but then I figure that the least interesting thing in these speeches, these talks of mine, is myself. It's things I can remember, in which maybe I played a very small part, but I'm not anxious to publicize myself. I did, along with Jeffrey Koop, whom I mentioned, is taking George Moy out fishing. He and I did the book and lyrics of 2 musical comedies that were produced here. Hall Macklin did the music, And one of them was GI's Right, which was done when we had 600 soldiers and 600 sailors on the campus during the war. And the other was Sing Senator Sing, which was done twice, once in 1948 and again in 1952. And as the name suggests, it had to do with the political problems of a singing senator. And I thoroughly enjoyed the project, and I'm sure that Coop and Macklin enjoyed it too. And we managed to fill the auditorium four nights in a row in both cases with standing room only. So I guess the crowd seemed to like it. But I could tell all kinds of stories about producing an original musical comedy that, well, as I say, that's not ancient history enough to...
No, it isn't.
...to
no.
use here.
You know,
if you're interested by someday when you want to turn the tape recorder off, there's a few episodes that were amusing enough to repeat, but...
Well, why don't you tell me a little bit of it, just...
Well, I think the most amusing thing about it that I can remember was that after the, in connection with Sing Senator Sing, no, wait a minute, in connection with G.I.'s Right, the hit song was a rather saccharine thing called Tomorrow and Tomorrow. We wrote the song because we'd been trying to write the best words we could, Coop and I, and Macklin had been trying to write the best music he could, at least the best music that's fitted to a musical comedy. And Coop, one evening when we were together, said, you know, there's one thing that we don't have. We don't have anything that is so obviously a steal that everybody's going to be pleased because he can recognize where we got it. And Macklin and I agreed, oh, we should have something like that, all right. And Jeff and I decided, well, we'll steal something that everybody recognizes, something from Shakespeare. And Macklin, I don't remember where he got his tune for it, but he, at least the first three or four notes of it were enough of a theme that if a person knew enough music, maybe he'd recognize it. I wouldn't have. I'm not trying to take anything from Macklin's originality for that tune. It was a marvelous thing, I must admit. But anyway, Jeffrey and I decided, well, we'll take something from Shakespeare, and we got this line of Shakespeare's, tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. And we could only work in two tomorrows, but we sat down and threw the whole thing together, just the most slapdash form we could imagine. And we thought it was completely trite, completely banal, and just absolutely horrible. And Macklin, I don't know how long he labored on the music, but I don't think he worked too awfully long on it. And it just happened that in the war, when people were wishing things were as they had been, that song hit them. It was the hit song. And when they took an orchestra, a singing orchestra on tour, they always put that tune in. It was the only song they ever had, and it was the finale for the show. Mm. And the payoff came. Well, when we had G.I.'s Right, one woman came from Potlatch. Not when they had G.I.'s Right, but when they had this singing orchestra that I mentioned. She came from Potlatch because she said that she wanted to hear Tomorrow and Tomorrow again. And let's see, Dr. Church, whose home we're now the museum that we're talking in, went to see it a second night because he wanted to hear that song again. We thought it was terrible. But then the real payoff came. When Reverend Mr. Walter of the Presbyterian Church, the next Easter, told Mr. Macklin that to end his Eastern sermon, he wanted to quote the words of Tomorrow and Tomorrow, while Macklin, who was the Presbyterian organist, played the tune, soft music in the background.
So this tomorrow and tomorrow is tomorrow and tomorrow. What is it? Breathes in the.
I wish I could. If I were.
I'm trying to think of which Shakespearean play it's from. Is it Macbeth?
Don't remember. I just.
It's so familiar to me. And
I know, and to me too. And if I weren't working so hard, I could probably come up with it fast. But Macklin was horrified. He said, "You can't do that." And Mr. Waller said, "Well, I not only can, I'm going to." I might mention that Mr. Waller's son was in that show, but I don't think that's what made him like the song. The son didn't sing it. But he said, "What's more, I'm going to." And he said, "You are going to play that beautiful tune of yours in the background." Macklin said, Macklin has colorful language. He says, "Don't you know that the words of that song were written by a couple English profs that almost throw up every time they think about it?" And Walter said, "If they don't recognize something that is beautiful, that is not my fault." And Macklin said, "Well, boys, we're really a success." He said, "We write a musical comedy, and the hit song sends the audience home weeping because they did cry during it. And the clergyman uses it as the theme of an Easter sermon." He says, "We really haven't made in our field a musical comedy."
Tell me.
I did think that it was really funny enough.
What about that song we're talking about? And this is a significant. What was it, you think, that made people feel that?
Because all that they wanted during the war was to have things the way that they used to be. The most unimaginative, worst line I can think of that I ever had any connection with was, "We'll do all the things we used to do." We had an ooh rhyme, you see. We had to have blue and true and you. And I can remember, I said, "Well, what else are we going to do?" And Jeffrey says, "Well, we'll do all the things we used to do." Well, that scans, so we threw it into the song. But that's just what people wanted. They wanted things to be the way that they had been.
The way that things had been, not the way they'd been in the Depression, though.
Oh no, this was in 1946 or so. But I can recall when the war was over and we were able to revive football. I was in charge of the deal at that time, of the business side of it, and some of the kids that had been in and out of the office a lot came in. We were going to have football, and we were going to have homecoming, and they said, "Oh, and do you suppose we could have a fireworks display the way that we used to?" Been mostly girls in the student body during the war, and I said, "Well, of course we're going to have a fireworks display. I just finished ordering a couple $1,000 worth of fireworks and a man down from Spokane to shoot them off." Those kids began to cry. They said, "We didn't think we'd ever have this experience. Other people had had it. We thought we'd come and go here, and we'd never had the things that the other people had had."
Huh. Well,
no, that tomorrow, it just seemed to get under their skin somehow.
You know, when you talking about the Sing Senator Sing and about 1952 made me think of one thing from that more contemporary time that I want to ask you about. Now, I know it's not having anything to do with the show that you did, but Sing Senator Sing somehow made me think of McCarthyism during that period of time. And I wanted to ask you what kind of effect you recall McCarthyism having on the campus at that period of time.
I don't, I can't remember anything striking. There was supposed to be, at one time, somebody who was on the campus as an undercover person for the McCarthy Committee. And whether there was any truth in it or not, I could not say. But old people would get a little bit alarmed about something once in a while. But I don't recall that it, I know it didn't affect my teaching. I said what I wanted to say, and I don't know of anyone else among my acquaintances who was afraid to say what he thought, whether I don't mean that there was anything in what they thought that was that should have aroused anything, but you never knew what was going to arouse some excitement at that time. No, I can't recall that it. Maybe there are other people who can who know things that I don't, mm-hmm. but I didn't wasn't aware of any great impact here, any fear on the campus and in the faculty or anything like that.
I really don't know about it here. I know about it at my school where I went to school, and it was rather devastating in my school.
Is that right?
At Reed, yes, it was. A
oh well, Reed
difficult
it,
experience.
Reed, it would be.
Reed was always somewhat controversial.
It had. A reputation for going pretty far out on some things, and I say that with all the respect in the world for Reed, which is never let it be said that I don't respect that school, or that some people thought that was radical, means that I think any the less of it. That was never my opinion that there was anything to think badly about. But I would think it would be much more likely to stir up that kind of problem there than here. This has been usually a fairly conservative school and a fairly conservative state.
Do you think that the faculty members were concerned individually about McCarthy? I mean, that they felt that this was a rather destructive influence? In
yes,
the
I think
country?
I think the ones that I knew were almost unanimously of the opinion that this was a very destructive thing to do. The reputations were being torn down, and alarms being raised without any justification at all.
You know, that reminded me of that story that I wanted you to repeat to me, which you told me at least in part before, which was about President Lindley's son coming to the campus. In the 30s, was it, that he gave that?
That was in the 30s, I'm sure. I'm sure it was not in the 40s.
No, I think you told me it was in the 30s. But what was the story of that?
Oh, he had this Ernest K. Lindley, of course, well-known writer and journalist, had been a student here when his father was president. He was a Rhodes Scholar then afterward. And he was brought back to give the commencement address and came back a few days before commencement, just to meet people that he knew and that his father knew and spend a few days in the town. And during his talk, he mentioned having been enjoyed being around the town where he'd gone to school, where his family had lived, and been interested to see what it was like now that he'd been away for a while, came back with a perspective. He said, one question that interested me that I have asked a good many times as I've talked to people, I've asked, are there any communists in Moscow? And he says, I've always had the same answer. No, there isn't a single communist in this town. He paused for effect and then said, I consider that most unfortunate. You should have seen the audience straighten up. That because communism, whether we like it or not, is a force in this world that is going to be heard from. And we had better become aware of its existence and know something about it, and it would not be a bad thing at all for people to have first-hand exposure to what a communist really is. But he certainly brought the audience to its feet on that.
You think they accepted what he had to say?
I believe they took it. I believe as they thought about it, why they realized that there's no sense in hiding your head in the sand. If something exists, you better know something about it.
Of course, he was coming at this time here from an Eastern experience, right? I mean, he was coming from a city, urban...
Oh, yes. He had already become one of the best-known news writers in the country, and that meant he was living in the East and met everybody in the Eastern establishment, everybody anti-establishment in the East too.
So he was undoubtedly exposed and knew himself.
He was exposed. No question about that.
I was going to ask you about President Upham. Did you know him?
Not very well, no. Not enough that I had any more than just met him at receptions and maybe talk a few minutes in a group at a reception or something like that. I know enough about him to know that he was immensely popular, and that for many years after he left, a great many people thought of the years when Upham was here as kind of the golden age, but I didn't have that experience myself.
Well, the man that followed him, that was only here for 2 years,
Kelly.
Did you know him at all?
I met Kelly when I was teaching in southern Idaho, and there was some kind of a banquet in which Kelly was down there as a speaker. And I had a chance to meet with him and talk with him a little while on that occasion. I couldn't say I knew him well, but he was gone by the time I came back to the faculty. I never did feel that I entirely understood what were the difficulties with him. Any stories I've heard or any explanations are so far in the past that I don't think I should even attempt to recall them now.
As I recall, he was deeply committed to the junior college approach that he had, that he believed strongly in the 2 years of broad preparation and
I think that was the way of it, that he had in mind, now I could be wrong on this, but they had in mind a situation in which all students would be enrolled in a junior college for the first 2 years, and thereafter would enter the professional colleges or continue in the liberal arts program, and that he ran into opposition from the deans of colleges such as engineering, mines, agriculture. That's the way I've heard it, but I can't say from personal knowledge that I know that to be the case. I do know that not long after he left, the junior college, of course, was eliminated. And so that seems to make the story sound plausible.
Mm-hmm. Was George Moore Miller the chairman of the English department during the years that he was here?
Yes, from the time he came until the time he died.
Did being chairman entail much in those days? What did it mean?
Well, it would mean, of course, that you would be responsible for choosing the faculty, although you might consult other faculty members if you want to do, but pretty much at that time the department head acted on his own. They called it head then, not chairman. And it would mean handling the budget. I'm going to have to get a drink here. My voice is going on. Got a swallow of water anywhere?
What the shape of the English department was when you were a student in those years.
Well, the chairman was responsible for choosing the new faculty members. He probably had more say than anyone else about who should stay and who should not stay. He did more than anyone else about deciding what courses should be offered and what should not. He assigned the teachers to the courses that they were to teach. And so in that way, he pretty much had control of he handled the budget, of course, which was, for the most part, it was salary. But in general, he did just about everything except teaching all the actual classes. He ran the show. And at that time, in our department, and I think in every other, so far as I know, it was not by any means the faculty participation in the decision-making that has come to be the natural thing now. And as for what the courses were, I think that considering the size of the department and the number of faculty available and the number of classes that you could fill with students, I think they had a pretty good representation of material. They had, of course, their general survey courses of English and American literature. They had a pretty good selection of courses in the periods. They had special courses in Shakespeare and Chaucer. They genre courses, you might call them, courses in such areas as drama or the novel poetry. They had some work in creative writing. And of course, they didn't have as many in each of those lines as you might have in a larger school, but I don't know that they would have improved the situation if they had had more and more courses, because the individual could only take a certain number of credits anyway. And if you only take 128 credits to graduate, there's no particular reason to think that if they'd brought in some peripheral courses which some people had substituted for those that you might say were the basics, many people would have come out with a better general understanding in the field.
Well, I think the thing along this line that I want to ask you is that looking at the Blue Bucket, talking to the Boazes a little bit about the creativity of students and the interest that there was in writing and in English at that time, it sounds as though there was a lot of talent on campus then, right around that period. And I was wondering whether you would say that there were people in the department or a certain kind of cultural atmosphere that encouraged people to pursue writing and English as a career then, right around that period of time when this Blue Bucket was coming out. And where was this impetus for creative writing, for instance?
I don't really know where that came from. I hadn't especially thought that we were any more numerous then than we became later. But I don't know, I couldn't really account for it. And for that matter, I guess there's plenty of interest in writing now, but I don't know enough about what they're trying to get them to create now.
I was wondering if George Morey Miller, John Cushman, some of the faculty had a particular, some kind of hold on the students that got them interested in following this as a career. It seems like they might have been pretty good models for.
Well, I don't know. I don't know of either of those two, or for that matter, of the faculty in general, trying to do much in the way of creating writing themselves.
Well, I don't mean just the writing. I'm really thinking of literature as a teaching and newspaper and all that.
We had a stimulating faculty at that time, I think, but then I don't think it was any more stimulating than it's been a great deal of the time since then. That is, I think, compare the people that were on the faculty then with those that I knew for the 36 years beginning in the early 1930s, I think that we stacked up pretty well later on too. I have plenty of people that were, could stimulate a student's enthusiasm.
Well, why don't we...
Bill Banks, for example.
Bill Banks.
Bill Banks, yes.
Was he a very highly regarded teacher?
Oh, yes, he was. We hadn't better get started on Bill. He's a subject in itself.
Okay, we should save him for next time then. Okay, let's do that.